Vedanta Swami Chan. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaurava. Chaitanya Vishesha Shunyavada Pushchati Rastham. Oh, wow. Can I read Bhagavad Gita? Is that allowed? Still allowed in ISKCON? Only kidding. Okay. Is that what we normally do? Read Bhagavad Gita? What? Okay. Mukam karuti vachalam bhango langayate girin yakripa tamaham bande siguru dinatharinam. By the mercy of the spiritual master, even a lame man can climb mountains, a dumb man can speak poetry, and a blind man can see stars in the sky. I'm looking for one verse. Give me a moment. Guess not that verse. I can't find it. So a similar verse. 7th chapter. Icha Dvesha Samuttena. Who knows that verse? Icha Dvesha Samuttena Dvanda Mohena Bharata Sarva Bhutani Samaham Sarga Yanti Parantapa. Here it is. It's text 27 from chapter 7. Icha Dvesha Samuttena Dvanda Mohena Bharata Sarva Bhutani Samaham Sarga Yanti Parantapa. O son of Bharata, O conqueror of the foe, all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by dualities arisen from desire and hate. Purport. The real constitutional position of the living entity is that of subordination to the Supreme Lord, who is pure knowledge. When one is deluded into separation from this pure knowledge, he becomes controlled by the illusory energy and cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The illusory energy is manifested in the duality of desire and hate. Due to desire and hate, the ignorant person wants to become one with the Supreme Lord and envies Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Pure devotees who are not deluded or contaminated by desire and hate can understand that Lord Sri Krishna appears by his internal potencies. But those who are deluded by duality and essence think that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is created by material energy. This is their misfortune. Such deluded persons symptomatically dwell in dualities of dishonor and honor, misery and happiness, woman and man, good and bad, pleasure and pain, etc., thinking, this is my wife, this is my house, I am the master of this house, I am the husband of this wife. These are the dualities of delusion. Those who are so deluded by dualities are completely foolish and therefore cannot understand the Supreme Personality of God. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So, icha means desire, dvesha means hatred, and dvanda means duality. So, in this verse, Krishna is kind of giving a, you could say, a synopsis of the nature of material consciousness and material life, that we're entrapped by duality. And the next word Krishna uses is moha. Moha means bewildered. So, in the purport, Prabhupada gives some examples of duality that we're all entrapped by. Good and bad, pleasure and pain, man and woman, misery and happiness, honor and dishonor. This is my wife, this is my house. So, the other verse that was similar to this that I was looking for, Krishna says, attraction and repulsion are felt by all embodied beings. Who knows that verse? Who knows where it is? Gita Nagari? No? There's rust in my brain right now, so I can't remember. But similar, and what Krishna is saying is that we're being pulled by duality. That's just how the word works. We're being pulled by it. And if we don't control that pulling, it just takes us wherever it takes us, whimsically. Just like in another place in the Gita, Krishna says, Shastra Vidim Utsrija Vartate Kama Karata. This is the word Kama Karata. Of course, we know kama means lust or desire. But Prabhupada translates kama karata as whimsical. And he positions whimsical against shastra. If you follow shastra, you're not whimsical. If you don't follow shastra, you're whimsical, basically. Shastra is controlling. And so you either do what shastra says, or you do whatever you feel like. And then when you do whatever you feel like, as Prabhupada says here in the purport, then you are granted a position in the illusory energy. And the illusory energy does whatever she feels like with you. So we basically have two choices. To get pulled by attraction, repulsion, or duality, desire and hate, or to make a decision to be transcendental to that and act according to our intention to be Krishna conscious. And that's basically how the material world works. That's how we got here. And we get out of here by making the right choices. We got in here by making the wrong choice. Yes? Did we make the wrong choice? Yeah. And so once we make the wrong choice, then Maya starts making all the other choices for us until we again make the right choice. And until we make that choice, then what Krishna is saying is that what attracts you and what repulses you will define your decisions. That's how you'll decide what you want to do and what you don't want to do. It's just you like it or you don't. If you don't like it, you stay away. If you like it, you go forward. That's it. That's how decisions will be made. So if we want to become Krishna conscious and we're acting on that platform, it's going to be real difficult because decisions will be made for us based on what we like and what we don't like. And if we want to be Krishna conscious, then it's going to be different. We're going to have to make decisions which defy the nature of Maya. Now, the nice thing is that Prabhupada said material energy is on our side because she's only there for those who want her. And when you don't want her, she doesn't bother you anymore. Is that good news? Did you know that? Sometimes we say Maya is strong. Have you ever said that? Maya is strong. So, Prabhupada, of course, Maya is Radharani in external form. So Radharani pulls us to Krishna, Maya, Durga, pulls us away. So when you want Krishna, then Maya becomes Radha. When you don't want Krishna, Maya becomes Durga, or external energy. So it's not that Maya is against us, she's just fulfilling what you want. So you don't want Krishna, she's there. You want Krishna, she's there in another form. So when we say Maya is so strong, that's true. Krishna says that. Mama Maya Dharatya. But at the same time, it's only because we would invite Maya, so to speak, to be strong. Then she's strong. And you know the example Prabhupada gives? Some man's embracing a tree and he's complaining. Let me go, let me go. You know that example? So that's the analogy that Maya is strong. We're embracing Maya, and then we're saying Maya is strong. So, my realization is that Maya, she comes when she's called for, when she's invited. And Radha comes when she's invited. So the energy that's affecting us is by invitation. You agree? Invitation only. We invite Maya, she comes. We invite Radha, she comes. So if one is doing well in Krishna consciousness, that means they're nicely inviting Radha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram. You know, Prabhupada once gave a definition of the Maha Mantra. He said, "Oh Radha, oh Krishna, please engage me. For so long I've been engaged in serving the material energy, the material world. I'm tired of it. I'm finished with it. I just want you. Please give me your service." So that's the idea. That's the meaning of the Maha Mantra. That I realize the nature of this world, but this world tends to pull me. I don't want to be pulled. I want to be pulled to you. I want that energy. I want to be uplifted. So please give me that power. Please uplift me. So therefore, if a devotee is chanting nicely, praying to be uplifted, then he gets Radha's mercy. Hare Krishna, Radha Krishna. And if one wants Maya, as Prabhupada said, Maya is strong because our purpose is not strong, then Maya comes. And then we invite Maya, then she comes, and then the first question he has is, why did you come? As if we didn't invite her. So whenever we say Maya is strong, we should think in terms of, I must have invited her, because she won't come if I don't ask. You agree? We have that experience, yes? We chant nicely. Devotional service comes. The internal energy uplifts us. We're not doing well. We don't chant well. Then external energy comes and says, go here, go there. That's the idea. So, Prabhupada has said many times that Krishna fulfills everyone's desire. So then someone thinks, well, I don't have a mansion and a Mercedes-Benz, so I guess Krishna didn't fulfill my desire. That's one way of looking at it. But the actual way that it's meant is that our desire to be Krishna conscious will always be fulfilled by Krishna if it's our desire. And so if we're not as Krishna conscious as we'd like to be, simply we have to strengthen that desire. Krishna will fulfill it. That's his promise. And if we're not as Krishna conscious as we like to be, we may question if we're actually desiring to be as Krishna conscious as we think we want to be. Or if we're more in the mood of I want to be, but I don't want to execute the process, which would help me become Krishna conscious. So we're not going to get it that way. But if we want it, Krishna will give it. That's his promise. You want to be Krishna conscious, I'll give you. I'll give you Krishna consciousness. The Dhammi Buddha Yogam Tam. Prabhupada said the real reason Krishna accompanies the conditioned soul is not to guide him in the material world or give him intelligence for material activities, but it's actually to guide him out of the material world. And Krishna's always ready for that. So whenever we want guidance out of the material world, he's ready. Krishna's saying, yes, that's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for you to ask that. That's why I'm with you for all these lifetimes. If you don't ask it, I'll facilitate whatever desire it is that you want. So we always have to look at ourselves. If there's a problem in our Krishna consciousness, then you have to look at ourselves. Is it my desire weak? Is my desire weak? That's all. And if we think Maya is strong, then we have to ask ourselves, am I inviting Maya? So what I like about this verse and the other verse, attraction and aversion, is it kind of makes it clear the nature of this world is to attract us by our senses. Either the things we like or things we don't like. And that, if we're not intentional about our Krishna consciousness, then that's basically what we get. And we just kind of get pushed around. And then we end up in situations which maybe we didn't desire. We suffer. The redeeming value of suffering is it's purifying and it strengthens intelligence, and sometimes that's the only way we can learn something. So if we don't like suffering, then we have to do what Krishna wants. But if we don't do what Krishna wants and there's suffering, there's some redeeming value, because we get the idea that was the wrong thing to do. Yes? We learn and we promise that we won't do it again. And then we do it again, right? Have you ever done that? Again? The thing you promised you wouldn't do again? Yeah, we've all done that. It's kind of a process of purification. If you're a devotee, you'll learn from that. And after so many times of doing it again, at some point, when you say, I never do it again, you actually don't do it again. And that's also part of the process of advancing. So Krishna, he's made the material world like such a great place, because if you want to go back to Godhead, it's fully facilitated. Just think of how glorious it is to get old. Nobody wants to get old, right? But it's actually glorious. Because if old age weren't there, if things were really nice, it would be extremely difficult to be Krishna conscious. Once the demigods, they were having some problem, they went to Vishnu and they said, can you solve our problem? Vishnu said, I can do better than solve your problem. I can just order a one-way ticket for all of you back to Godhead, all expenses paid, and you can go right now. What did the demigods say? Could you just solve our problem? We like it down here. Yes. That's what they did. Unbelievable, isn't it? Unbelievable. So Krishna is very smart. He knows that difficulties and things which are not perfect are helpful because it pushes us a little closer. So the world is designed in a way that if anyone wants to be Krishna conscious sincerely, has some fairly deep desire to be Krishna conscious, the world will just push him and he won't fight it. It'll just happen. You'll see Krishna keeps pushing you. I don't know if you have this experience. I had this experience which I call the womping. I don't know if womping is a word. I might have made it up. The womping experience. That if I do something or I think about doing something because of a weakness that I have, I get womped. And Krishna says, don't do that. It's not good for you. And he gives me a womp. And every time I do it, I get womped. Anyone have that experience? We can call it slapped. And what Krishna is doing, he's saying, this is bad for you. And every time you try to do this, I'm going to slap you. Because I don't want you to do it, because this is your weakness. You just think about it, I'll slap you. What to speak of try to do it. That's mercy. So Krishna is always watching out for us. He'll keep us in line. There is a story of how Krishna was helping someone. There was a man. He made a deal with Krishna. He said, can you give me like warning when I'm going to die so I can prepare? This is just a joke, but I don't know if it's really true. But anyway, it tells a good story. So he died. There was no warning. So when he went back to Godhead or Vaikuntha, wherever, Braj, wherever he went, he saw Krishna. He said, look, we got to talk. You broke your end of the deal. You told me you'd give me warning. You didn't give me any warning. I just died. He said, no, I gave you all kinds of warning. Well, what warning did you give me? He said, gray hair, wrinkles, bad knee, skin cancer, heart disease. I gave it all. You didn't notice it. So that's all Krishna's mercy. That is something. I don't know if I told you this story, but it illustrates this point. 1981, I went to South Africa. And I was living in San Diego at that time. And before I went to South Africa, they told me my assignment. I was going to be temple president of a temple in Johannesburg. And that temple, that was during apartheid. That temple was in a white area, and it was illegal for any Indians, colored, or blacks to live in that area. They could be arrested and or at least deported from that area. Everyone was living in their specific area. There's an area for Indians, an area for whites, an area for colors, an area for blacks. So that was a white area. So in Johannesburg, we were focusing on preaching to white people. And then we had a temple outside that was focusing on preaching to Indians. We had another temple in the black area. So each area had their own temple. And before I went, they called me up and they said, South Africa is one of the nicest, at this time, one of the nicest places in the world. This was 1981. The rand was worth $1.30. Now it's 16 rands to the dollar. At that time, it was extremely wealthy. And they said, you can't make devotees here, it's too nice. And I said, you're talking to a Mahatma. I'm not gonna take that sitting down. You know, it's like, I'm in San Diego. You know, it's like, we're making all kinds of devotees. San Diego, Southern California, you know, temples right by the beach. And after a year in San Diego, in South Africa, I had a realization. You want to know the realization? You can't make white people devotees in South Africa. It's too nice. Unbelievably nice, unbelievably wealthy. For white people, nice. Not for other, not, Indians it was okay, black people, not very nice. But they were talking about white people. And if you made them devotees, they couldn't stay. Because they never lifted a finger in their life. They were served. They had servants in their house. They were all very wealthy. It's the way the economy worked to support the white people. And they actually couldn't become devotees or stay devotees. It's extremely difficult for them. Now, fast forward to, I came back to South Africa after, 1983 was the last I was there, and then I came back there maybe 6 years ago. So fast forward to 2011. And what did I see there? Guess what I saw? White devotees. Amazing. Why were there white devotees there? The country had changed. Economic opportunities were much greater for blacks now, and not as great for whites. It was harder for them to find jobs. They weren't living on the same standard. Their life totally changed. And as a result, they started becoming devotees. Isn't that interesting? So, if it gets too nice, it's a problem. That's so Krishna has designed the world. It's not always so nice. If it's not always so nice, that's okay. If that helps us, it's okay. If it's too nice, it may be difficult. At least it was for them. That's my experience. So, I will end here. And if you have any comments or questions or doubts or whatever, or question on anything, it's okay. We don't have to just stick on this topic. Yes, sir. Hare Krishna.
You were speaking about desire.
Yes.
And how the material energy and how it works to push and pull us or womp us,
yes,
as you said. And I was a little bit confused with what I perceived to be a contradiction.
Okay.
We speak a lot about detachment, and the Nectar of Devotion has spoken about how detachment works, not really from avoiding things. And then we have what Srila Prabhupada, I understood, to have the vision for us was for us to live in the material world, work with it, to promote our Krishna consciousness. So what is the Vedic or Shastric injunction or direction that we should have when we're working with material energy? Do we avoid it? Do we work with it? How do we work with it? How do we avoid it?
It's the same principle. It's second chapter of the Gita. The word equipoised, that's the key word, sama. You know, sama, be equal in happiness and distress. I was once designing a course, the success principles of the Gita, so I would isolate different principles and I'd make them into, like, I think I call it the laws of success. And one of them was the law of sama, being equipoised. And the idea is, if you're not equipoised, two possibilities are going to happen. One, you're going to get really upset about something and your mind's just going to focus on it like a magnet and you won't be able to function well. Or you're going to get really elated about something good that happened and it'll have even a worse effect, a more bewildering effect. So you won't be able to be steady because you'll either be going up or you'll be going down. So detachment, acceptance, sama, equanimity, it's different nuances of the same principle.
By that logic, can you be equipoised doing something that you shouldn't be doing? Or is it a law that always happens?
That's another point.
Sorry.
You know, if you shouldn't be doing it, Meaning what? It's not your varna, or it's a sin, or it's sinful.
Just a general devil's advocate question.
Like the Buddhists say, well, I eat whatever I, you know, I'm detached. Whatever I'm given, I eat. Okay, here's some cockroaches. We'll eat those. And, but I think they eat meat because of that, or some sex. That's what I was told. No, I wouldn't say we should be equipoised when we're doing the wrong thing. I think that means we're just not being intelligent. But the way Krishna uses that, he's saying, look, if you're not equipoised, you're not going to be eligible for liberation. So all those verses are like equipoised, and then now you're in a good position where you can execute devotional service because you're not being pulled, or, oh, it's too hot, I can't do my service. It's too cold, I can't do it. It's too this, it's too that. Or I can't get along with devotees because they're too this or too that. So then you know, then it's attraction and repulsion. Desire and hate, we're just being pushed around by it rather than being able to focus on our bhakti. Like we all have experience. If you have a bad experience with a devotee or a bad experience that's pretty intense, then when you're trying to chant your rounds, you can't. Because all you can think about is that experience. We had a forgiveness workshop and we would ask the devotees, well, how does not forgiving impact your devotional service? And one devotee said that very thing. He said, I couldn't forgive this devotee. And so the whole time I was chanting japa, it was just going through my head. The resentment was just increasing. It was actually getting worse. He said it was getting worse as he was chanting. By the end of, you know, when he started chanting, it was bad. When he finished, it was pretty intense. Amazing, isn't it? That could happen. So if we can't be equipoised, then those kinds of things happen. Or, you know, this amazing verse in the Gita where Krishna says, don't get excited if things go well. You know, use the word, tolerate happiness. That's like amazing. You know? Make a t-shirt that says, tolerate happiness. And walk around with that. And people will go, what's that all about? It's such an interesting concept, tolerate happiness. But it's actually more important to tolerate happiness because it's more bewildering. Because pain, it's actually more purifying. You know, it reminds us that the world is painful. And happiness makes us forget the world's painful. Isn't it? It's just, everything's fine. Wow. Everything's great. Yeah. I haven't chanted Hare Krishna in like 15 years and things are, you know, like my stocks are going up. You know, the house value is going up. Yeah. The wife is great. Yeah, no problem. That is a problem. If Krishna rains on your parade, that's his mercy. If he needs to. Is that okay?
Thank you, Prabhu.
Okay. Yes.
Hare Krishna Mahaprabhu.
Hare Krishna.
I've heard that Srila Prabhupada is the preeminent Shiksha Guru for all of ISKCON.
Yes.
What does that mean?
I've heard that he isn't. What is it? No, some people say that Shiksha Guru is only a person who's alive, and Prabhupada is founder Charya Param Guru. But we're speaking about the same thing. You know, one of the simplest ways to understand it, that we're all here because of Prabhupada, and whoever your guru is, if he's not Srila Prabhupada, your Diksha Guru is only Diksha Guru because of Prabhupada. Without Prabhupada, he would not be a Diksha Guru, may not be a devotee. And because Prabhupada's founder Acharya, everything that we're understanding in Gaudiya Vaishnavism is ultimately filtered through his understanding. So if I learn something from the books of the Acharyas, it doesn't seem to line up with Srila Prabhupada, we always defer to Prabhupada's understanding. So in that way, he's everyone's guru. And every Diksha Guru is trying to bring you closer to Srila Prabhupada. Nectar of Devotion, it says, follow your guru. Follow the Acharya under the direction of your guru. You know, or something like that, come closer. How does that go? Follow in the footsteps of the Acharya under the direction of your guru, your spiritual master. So, one indifferent. I've always found, for me personally, that so many of my godbrothers help me understand Prabhupada better than I can understand them on my own. So to think that I could understand him on my own perfectly, it's not true, because I hear a class and someone clarifies what Prabhupada meant that I didn't fully understand. So I needed his help to understand that. So he's helped me come closer to Prabhupada. So we have to see this Sangha as like a lens, and everyone's focusing their lens to help us understand Prabhupada better. Not that you can't go directly or understand directly. But, you know, Prabhupada said his books for the next 10,000 years, that kind of sets it straight. One time, a devotee said, Prabhupada, did many people get your books and they'll never meet you and they won't get initiated? He said, my books are the initiation in that sense, that here's Siksha Guru through the book. So, yeah. When you join ISKCON, the injunction is 6 months, you don't choose a guru. You just focus on Prabhupada. And you get your foundation with Prabhupada clear. And what I'm finding nowadays in ISKCON, many people don't have that foundation clear. They don't understand Prabhupada that well. They've come listening and learning from others and not studying and hearing from Prabhupada. So that's not good. Because then if something is said that's not in line with Prabhupada, they may not know that. They may not realize it. So, yes. Is that okay? Or you wanted to add something?
I'm just a little confused about parts of your answer. I've heard that there's three types of gurus, Shiksha, Diksha, and Vartma for Darshika. So, Srila Prabhupada's not my Diksha guru or my Vartma for Darshika guru. So if he's not my Shiksha guru, then what is he? And also,
He is your Shiksha guru. But generally, technically speaking, Shiksha gurus are alive. So he's your Param guru. That's the most accurate term. But of course, we refer to Prabhupada as Shiksha guru. But historically, Shiksha gurus were those who you were taking instruction from personally.
Is Srila Prabhupada not alive?
Well, they're referring to physically present. Prabhupada said he always lives, but the reference is to physical presence. Like Diksha Guru must be physically present. So in that sense, traditionally when when someone was referred to as a Siksha Guru, it was a person you were taking Siksha from right now in front of you. But it's, you know, it's just splitting hairs. It's a technicality. You know, if you want to be strict, he's Param Guru. He's your Param Guru. But of course he's your Siksha Guru. You take instruction from him. So, is that okay? Or what's not clear?
Well, you started and you said that Srila Prabhupada, you've heard that he's not our preeminent Siksha Guru.
I said he is, but technically speaking, if you want to be technically accurate, Siksha Guru is alive and teaching you.
I've heard there's Vapu and Vani, so the spiritual master may not be physically present forever, but his instructions are always there.
Yeah.
And instructions are Siksha. So a Siksha Guru then, in my understanding, would be someone who gives instructions even if they're not physically present.
You can say that. I was just being technical, but it's the same thing. You're taking instruction from Srila Prabhupada.
Where is it said he has to be physically present to be a Siksha Guru?
That, basically everywhere. There's nowhere that Prabhupada said, I'm the Siksha Guru of ISKCON. It's always Param Guru. But it's a technicality because it's the same thing. But if founder acharya, yeah. Prabhupada's a founder acharya, not the Diksha Guru of ISKCON, not the Siksha Guru of ISKCON, the founder acharya of ISKCON. So it's a technicality, but you're taking Prabhupada's books or his Siksha, his instructions or so. It's the same thing. It's just, it's a fine line technicality for academics. But for all intents and purposes, he's our foundational guru. That's who we follow. Everything comes through him. Everything we understand comes through him. We're all trying to follow him. We're trying to represent him. We're trying to bring everyone closer to him. You know, I was just in conversation with a god brother, and some of his disciples came to me for instruction. And so in discussing that, the nice thing about ISKCON is that the Siksha Guru is meant to bring you closer to the Diksha Guru. But in ISKCON, we're all meant to bring everyone closer to Prabhupada. So we're, you know, naturally we're the perfect Siksha Gurus for anybody, because we're all helping bring everyone to Prabhupada. Right? So it's we're very insulated, so it makes things easy, because we're trying to understand everything through Prabhupada, we're administering our resolutions through understanding what he wants, and then delivering that to the devotees in the temples, to disciples, to grand disciples. So it's very unified and solidified. When you go outside of ISKCON, there's a lot of freedom to mingle with those instructions and adapt them, change them, minimize them. Within ISKCON, we don't do that. We're very dedicated to being chaste to Prabhupada. And I was just reading something recently. It came from outside of ISKCON, which was a very good example, adaptation of what Prabhupada quote-unquote wanted that he never said he wanted. So generally you don't find that in ISKCON. We're always trying to be very chaste to understand what Prabhupada's mood is, what his desire is, and reflect that and teach that. And that's why it's so seamless, where you can have one guru but hear from so many gurus, because we're all trying to represent Prabhupada. So the Siksha Guru, Param Guru, it's the technicality, which is, you know, maybe for those who are more academically inclined, they like to discuss those things. Is that okay now? You're okay now? Yeah, you're welcome. Hare Krishna.
Hare Prabhu. Thank you for your class. When you were speaking about getting warmth, for myself, I'm getting warped all the time. And so, should the focus be on, more pure chanting?
Well, one of the focus should be to ask the question, why do I keep getting warped?
Yeah, that's.
And what am I supposed to learn? And what am I doing that Krishna is needing to want me? Part of the problem is our intelligence is not clear. And often our intelligence is not clear because of lust. And of course, chanting will purify us, but also reading Prabhupada's books, because Prabhupada's books purify the intelligence and put things in perspective. Because a lot of the times when we're desiring something which is not healthy, we're just out of perspective. We're not clear. And things get foggy, and Prabhupada knew they'd get foggy, and that's why Prabhupada gave us his books, because it clears the fog. And when the fog's clear, you can see. And when the fog's not clear, it's hard to see, and then we make bad decisions. So maybe like a couple of years ago, I was, you know, after dealing with a lot of counseling sessions, I was realizing that one of the big problems devotees are having now is they're not reading Prabhupada's books enough, and the consequence of that is the problems they're having. There's many, many cases when a devotee's having problems. If they're very severe, the first thing I'll say is, are you reading Prabhupada's books? And in most cases, the answer is no. And in most cases, that's the problem. In many cases, I say, well, just read his books an hour a day and come back to me if you still have a problem. In most cases, the problem's gone. So that was my realization, the clarity of intelligence that's needed to get out of the material world, because it's such a maze, and Maya is always putting fog on the road, and you can't see. Prabhupada's books are the light, and it opens it up. And when you have an enemy who's trying to bewilder you, if you know how that enemy's trying to bewilder you, they can't bewilder you. But if you don't know, then they come from behind the side and they trick you. And so I find Prabhupada's books are like that. It's kind of like Prabhupada is saying, the enemy comes this way, and it'll trick you this way, and it'll say this, and it'll do that. And so we read. So when Maya comes, we're like, oh, now I see how it's working. So I think that's very important. You could never minimize chanting, ever. Super important. Yes, sorry.
For the sake of clarity, could you reiterate this experience with the devotees
whose intensity, or his hatred or resentment was intensified because of his chanting.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense to me, because if it's prophylactic and antiseptic, then yeah. How or why is it the chanting that is concluded to be the attributed to the fault of chanting?
Very, very good question. Not all chanting is created equal. Because he was making aparad to that devotee while he was chanting. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, when you chant a nam aparad, it waters the weeds. So he was having a 16-round water weeding, weed watering session. And so at the end of the weed watering session, he was more upset. So, I think we could generalize this answer to assume that everything will get better while we do the process improperly would be a wrong assumption. And especially if we're committing nam-aparad, because once we could commit nam-aparad, things can only go downhill. And using the holy name to reinforce nam-aparad. The holy name was the background, the foreground was
the mind
focused on something that was bothering him about this person. And it was rousing the anger. It was actually stimulating the anger. And so the anger was stimulated by his chanting. It's possible. You know the story. In Mayapur, they're having this kirtan competition. And Prabhupada hears some professional kirtaneers chanting. And some Prabhupada said, they're not chanting Hare Krishna. And of course, everybody hears the Maha Mantra. Well, if they're not chanting Hare Krishna, what am I hearing? And Prabhupada said, they're chanting money, money, money. Because they wanted to win the competition and get money, and they're professional kirtaneers, so they make money by chanting. So their chanting is just producing a lust for money. So, you know, all chanting is not created equal. And then if you're chanting to gain something material, that's one definition of nam-aparad. And nam-aparad can't produce any purity. You can only facilitate material, agitate material desire. Is that okay, or you want to say something?
I'm still wanting to, I think it's more attributable to the mind than, just as you mentioned, that I thought it was that one might conclude that there's
chanting's not poetry.
Chanting was the significant, most significant factor, and thenceforth.
It's just, well, why don't we end the class on this note? We'll leave it up to the audience to decide what was the real factor. And maybe on next Sunday's speaker can take off from there. It's a very interesting question, considering that Mayavadis chant the holy name to become one with Krishna, and how the holy name can be used for many things. And when we commit nam-aparad, what is the result of that? Something to consider. Okay, so we're going to end here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sisi Radhe Shyam Sundar ki jai. Gaur Premanand Hari Hari. Hare Krishna.